Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Seth Manoukan, who is the Associate Director of MIT's Graduate Program in Science Writing and a contributing writer at Vanity Fair. He's the author of the 2006 New York Times bestseller, Feeding the Monster, How Money, Smarts, and Nerve Took a Team to the Top, Hard News, the Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. And his latest book is The Panic Virus, the True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Seth Manoukan.
Thank you so much for having me.
And polio has made a comeback. It was almost entirely eradicated. It was an epidemic that started particularly in the Victorian age and caused enormous amounts of death in Europe and the United States, but was successfully eradicated globally through the use of a vaccine. But now the World Health Organization has declared the spread of polio an international public health emergency with outbreaks in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, needing, according to the WHO, needing a coordinated international response. So your book, of course, A Panic Virus, focuses on the panic over vaccines, largely generated by an English doctor who was essentially a fraud, a guy called Andrew Wakefield. So there's two sort of separate issues here, but they seem related. We have also here in the United States a revival of whooping cough, which is related to people not vaccinating their children. Of course, a part of the vaccination program is polio itself. It hasn't hit us yet, but surely it's a matter of time before polio hits us as well.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. We were very close to eradication, or we're certainly talking about eradication within a decade of polio for polio worldwide a couple of years ago, and it is alarming that it has come back to the extent that it has. But it would be difficult for polio to get a foothold in this country right now, just because we do still have fairly good vaccine uptake rates. Polio hasn't been endemic in the U.S. in many, many years. So what we're seeing right now with polio is a small handful of countries where there were still some cases every year, it really flaring up into something of an epidemic. And I think one lesson that we can learn in the United States is what seems to be, at current day, a situation where we have all sorts of diseases essentially under control, like pertussis or whooping cough, like measles, like mumps and rubella. I think what this illustrates is how quickly that can change, and how scary and dangerous it is when we allow these very dangerous and oftentimes deadly infectious diseases to return to a population.
Well, polio is apparently in Pakistan, Cameroon, and Syria, and it's also on the list of the WHO. They include Afghanistan, Equatorial Guinea, Ethiopia, Iraq, Israel, Somalia, and Nigeria as posing an ongoing threat. But my understanding is, for example, Syria was polio-free for 14 years, and it was just recently reinfected with the virus from Pakistan, presumably one of the jihadis that have gone over there to fight. So what would then stop somebody from Pakistan bringing it here to the United States?
Well, the issue, I guess there are a couple of issues. One is just physical proximity. So obviously, you know, international borders mean less than they ever have, and people can obviously get on planes. But the physical proximity, the fact that we are surrounded by countries that are also polio-free is one thing. And the other thing is, if someone infected with polio came over to the United States, right now such a high percentage of our population is vaccinated that it would be very difficult for the disease to get enough of a toehold so that it was then we were actively infecting new people in the United States from cases of the disease that had originated in the United States. So even though polio had been declared eliminated in Syria, Syria never had as high a percentage of the population vaccinated as we do today. So that's why it was at more risk when something like this happened, when you started to see outbreaks in some of the surrounding countries.
But isn't that the problem here, that our vaccination rates are declining because largely because of misinformation and, you know, in effect, delusion, a lot of which came from this English doctor who, in league with some class action lawyers, came up with this link, or this supposed link between childhood vaccinations and autism, all of which has been completely disproved, and he's lost his medical license, and I think some of the lawyers are in jail, from my own recollection.
I'm not sure about the legal case. Certainly, he lost his medical license, and the paper that he published has been retracted. You're right. In a sense, what's really interesting, I think, and that's happening in the United States, is that if you look at the population as a whole, the vaccine uptake rates are still very strong, over 90% for most diseases. What we have definitely seen in the last 5 to 10 years is an increase in the number of communities where the vaccine uptake rate has declined to 80, 70, 60, even 50%. And in those communities, they then are incredibly susceptible to diseases, especially diseases like measles, which is the most infectious microbe known to humankind, and pertussis, which is also very, very, very infectious.
But my sense, Seth, is that since these childhood vaccinations involve basically a whole range of diseases are taken care of and prevented in these vaccinations that include chickenpox, diphtheria, measles, mumps, pertussis, whooping cough, polio, retrovirus, rubella, and tetanus. So given that pertussis is making a comeback and so is measles, and here in the state of California, you know, parents can sign a form that means their kids can come to school without having been vaccinated. There's a lot of concern amongst other parents that this is going to lead to outbreaks. So the fact that polio is a part of the mix, I know you've suggested that it's not likely to happen here, but if people are not immunizing their kids for whooping cough, they're also not immunizing their kids for polio.
Well, actually, it's one of the interesting things, and I think one of the sort of oddities of vaccine hesitancy and the anti-vaccine movement in the United States is that it actually tends to focus on diseases that are still around and are still present in the U.S., which I would have made the exact same assumption that you did, which is if there are people who are delaying vaccines or skipping vaccines altogether, they would skip something like polio because we haven't had cases of polio in this country really for decades. But what we've actually seen is that it tends to be a couple of the combined vaccines, as you mentioned, the MMR vaccine, which is measles, mumps, and rubella, and then the DTP vaccine, which is diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, that a lot of parents are either delaying or avoiding. I shouldn't say a lot of parents, that the parents who are delaying or avoiding vaccines are delaying or avoiding those two. And so you have this sort of somewhat, I guess, paradoxical situation where parents who are choosing not to vaccinate are choosing not to vaccinate their kids against the very diseases that they're going to be most susceptible to, which I guess is an illustration of how logic kind of doesn't come into play a lot in this situation, because if it did, then you wouldn't have this situation in the first place.
Well, I think you've hit on something key there, Seth Mnookin, and that is logic in this increasingly faith-based world that we live in. I've actually tried to convince parents that I know to immunize their kids, and they have been literally influenced by this phony English doctor study, or this doctor's phony study, I should say, that who now lost his medical license and was withdrawn from the Lancet. It's like the 9/11 truthers. Once they get this fixation in their head about Building 7 and the government's inside job, there seems to be nothing you can do about it. And that's what I find so extraordinary, is that this rigidity, this inflexibility, that where people dig their heels in, and just once they accept one of these bogus anti-scientific beliefs, you know, it's pretty hard to shake them.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I try and differentiate between the sort of conspiracy theorists, and there are certainly plenty of those in the anti-vaccine movement, and it sounds like you might have been speaking with some of those, the ones who believe that there's a giant cover-up. And for those type of people, any evidence that you give them supporting the fact that vaccines are safe and that there have been safety studies done tends only to reinforce their belief in the conspiracy, which is the exact same thing you see with 9/11 truthers. So, you know, you say, look, here's a study that shows that you don't need to be worried. And the response often is, well, why would you need to show me that study if there was nothing to worry about? It's a sort of logic vacuum that it's easy to fall down. With a larger portion of the population who have kind of picked up some of these fears or concerns almost by osmosis, because they've heard them on the playground or from other parents, or might have spotted a headline in a newspaper and didn't actually read the whole story, I think we do have a better chance of reaching those parents. But one issue we have right now is that there's not really an effective communication strategy. And I think we're also coming up against a real problem with the healthcare system as it currently exists, and that's that it's very difficult for doctors and for pediatricians to find the time to really sit down with parents and have a discussion with them about vaccines. You know, oftentimes wellness appointments are 15 minutes long, and you need to get, you know, X, Y, and Z done, or you're not going to get reimbursed for the appointment. And so when I talk to parents, one thing I hear often is parents saying, you know, I just don't feel like my doctor is listening to me. And when I talk to doctors, they often say, we just don't have time to have these discussions. And I think that's a very crucial problem that we need to try and kind of work our way out of, or it's possible the situation is going to get worse.
Well, one of the paradoxes of trying to argue with people who are putting their children at risk by not vaccinating them is that they will say, well, you know, these diseases have been eradicated, so why should we bother? And that's at the heart of the problem, because somehow other people don't understand the herd concept.
Right, exactly. So, one thing you can tell them certainly is that there's only one disease that's been eradicated, and that is smallpox. All the other diseases, and we're not vaccinated against smallpox. So all the diseases that we are vaccinated against are currently still around in the world, certainly. And most of them are around in the United States. It is vaccines. There is this sort of paradox where vaccines almost seem to be a victim of their own success. So, you know, the more effective they are, the less often you see these diseases, and the less often you see them, the more parents start to feel like, well, you know, I don't know anyone who's ever had measles, or I don't know anyone who's ever, you know, been blinded because of rubella. I do think that is a real issue. Unfortunately, you know, just in the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen how quickly that can change, because there have been some of the largest outbreaks of measles in decades, and these outbreaks have been growing both in number and in number of patients. And one thing that I think everyone can and should really be concerned about, even if your children are vaccinated, even if you don't have children or your children are all old and out of the house, is that when there is one of these measles outbreaks, it's incredibly, incredibly expensive to contain. And there was a study actually done based on a San Diego measles outbreak in 2008 that found that containing each individual case costs more than $10,000. You know, as everyone knows, we're not living in a time of budget surpluses. And so when you have a local public health authority that's spending tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on something that's really totally unnecessary, I think that's cause of concern for everyone, because that's all money that can and should be spent towards other things that need the attention.
Well, Seth Manoukian, in terms of the outbreak of polio coming back in Pakistan, as we know that some of the health workers have been murdered by the Taliban, and a lot of that was in response to the fact that the CIA used polio vaccine as a cover to get the DNA from the household where bin Laden was hiding. And, you know, I've heard reports in the Pakistani press essentially blaming the CIA for the return of polio. But in this country, how much can you hold people like Jenny McCarthy and Oprah Winfrey culpable?
I think you can hold them fairly culpable. You know, Jenny McCarthy has been a very effective spokesperson for this mistaken notion that vaccines cause autism. She's been incredibly vocal about it, and one of the ways she's been able to be so vocal about it is because she's been given access to some of the most popular shows on TV, like the Oprah Winfrey Show. I actually think it's in some ways more irresponsible of Oprah than of Jenny McCarthy, because I try to give people the benefit of the doubt, and so I'm going to try and assume that Jenny is a mother who actually is, all she's trying to do is do what she believes is best for her child. Oprah really functions both as a television personality and to some extent as a journalist. And I think what she did in really legitimizing what was not a legitimate viewpoint on multiple occasions with Jenny McCarthy was abhorrent, and something that she really should be quite ashamed of.
Well, Seth Manoogian, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Seth Manoogian, who is an associate director of MIT's graduate program in science writing and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's the author of the 2006 New York Times bestseller, Feeding the Monster, How Money, Smarts, and Nerve Took a Team to the Top, and Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. And his latest book is The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.